And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, so finish up those taxes, get them in the mail, and then take a break, a tax break, and celebrate the end of another fiscal cycle with a journey back to nature. Next week is National Park Week, and you just help support our national parks with your tax donation to our national budget. They belong to you. So when we return, we give you some ideas on how to enjoy your national parks here on your Voice of the Earth, the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Tax time. I always wonder how many of my regular listeners won't find the time this time to tune in. It makes me think that maybe next year I'll dedicate my tax time show to nothing but soothing music. It would be a tax tune-in. I'm done. I actually got my taxes in a week ago. So for any of you still burning the midnight oil, realize this too shall pass. And speaking of oil, what do you think about these new gasoline prices? I keep hearing about the average price being above $2 per gallon. Hey, living in San Diego, I'd welcome a return to those high gas prices, those new high gas prices, as I see nothing but $2.48, $2.53 per gallon. It's an interesting time indeed as the world tries to see what the future really will be. Truth is, I don't think we really know. Modernization, globalization, call it what you will, is putting strains on our capacity to manage it all. There's no place for micromanagers any longer. We are all becoming a world of macromanagers. Today, we try to offer a balance. Following the news, we start out with a quick exploration of the upcoming National Parks Week, and then tell you how you may become a volunteer in a national park. Did you know that over 140,000 people do that every year? Then, in segment 2, we talk with a producer of a wonderful series that's been running on PBS, which has analyzed our global condition from a variety of perspectives. Journey to Planet Earth is in its final 2 weeks. We talk with the show's producer, Hal Weiner, who has traveled the world to tell this story and hear his thoughts on the future of Planet Earth based on this incredible undertaking to create Journey to Planet Earth. Then, in our final segment, we bring you an update on the Great Yosemite National Park Redevelopment Project, as we talk with Park Ranger Adrian Freeman about their upcoming dedication and what you can look forward to during your next visit to the Shrine to the Magnificent. So, let's get started. And first, the news. The House continues its debate over the energy bill, which is being promoted by the administration. The bill provides billions of dollars in tax advantages to promote expanding oil and gas leases and includes a controversial provision which gives the federal government the final say on natural gas leases, overriding local and state opposition. It also includes a provision which removes all liability from oil refineries which have incorporated the toxic chemical MTBE into their mix. With the stripping of the ANWR provision, the energy bill has a high chance of passing. Think oil prices are high now? Wait till you hear what major world economists are saying. Economists from the International Monetary Fund conclude that with the current demands on a dwindling supply of oil, prices could easily reach $80 and even $100 per barrel, but that such would only minimally impact the strong global economy. A contrasting view is offered by European Central Bank President Jean-Claude Trichet, who referred to the effects as oil shock. A news story appeared recently on MSNBC with a powerful graphic showing a pizza, with pieces disappearing as the price of oil takes away our discretionary pizza money. The Wildside News, meanwhile, reports that there is a galling lack of serious discussion of the impacts rising oil prices will have in the very near future on the economic strength of most Americans and thus the overall U.S. economy. And in news from around the world, the deadly Ebola virus is taking a very serious toll on the gorilla and chimpanzee population in the world's largest preserve, the Odzala National Park in the Republic of the Congo. Recent studies suggest that as much as 20-30% of the population has died in the last 10 years. This translates into tens of thousands of animals. The situation poses a critical challenge to the survival of these species. Attempts to block the spread include development of a vaccine, which could take a minimum of 2 to 3 years, and removing fallen trees that span rivers used by gorillas and chimps to cross, as they fear crossing open water. The challenges of globalization are reaching critical mass. Amazingly, in a somewhat related story, scientists in Japan are proposing bringing back the woolly mammoth following the sensation generated by a display of a frozen woolly mammoth at the 2005 World Exposition in Japan. Scientists pose the possibility of collecting sperm from an as yet undiscovered frozen woolly mammoth in Siberia, injecting it into a female elephant and attempting to create a hybrid elephant-mammoth cross. If successful, an offspring that would be 88% pure mammoth could be created within 50 years. Other researchers question the ethics of such a plan, as the creature would be developed strictly as a showpiece, as no natural habitat remains on the Earth. But the Japanese scientists agree that this is precisely their intention, and to in fact develop a public sanctuary demonstration project for the newly created beasts. No matter how you look at it, it is a mammoth undertaking. And to push this just a step closer to the edge, paleontologists at North Carolina State University are excited about a recent discovery of a T-Rex that preserved soft tissues. The discovery was made somewhat by accident, as the unearthing was done in a remote area requiring all access to be made by helicopter. The common practice of encasing significant portions of the bones in plaster made the capsule too heavy for liftoff, so a leg bone was re-exposed and broken to make a smaller package, and voila! This is the first example of soft tissue remains from a dinosaur. As yet, no plans are being made to try to clone the animal. And that's the news. And now a few announcements. Take a stroll into the archives. It is one of the most complete collections of Earth-friendly topics anywhere in the world. It's a great place to invite any of your friends to visit if they need a deeper understanding of the wonders of our planet. This is Your Voice of the Earth. Now, here's a great idea just for you. Looking for a little adventure, something new, a chance to get away, and do something exciting and meet a lot of great new people? All of us need regular chances to get out and enjoy our natural world. And thanks to the wisdom of our earlier generations, we have the opportunity to celebrate our national park system. This might be a great time to visit a national park, particularly during National Park Week. To learn more about that, I talked with a spokesperson for National Park Week about how you can find out what's happening in your neck of the woods.
We're talking with Shannon Stone, who works in the Partnership Office out of Washington, D.C. for the National Park Service. Shannon, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is National Park Week. What is National Park Week?
National Park Week actually started in about 1991, and it was developed out of a National Park Week proclamation, which is signed by the president. It just designates a week for America to celebrate their national parks.
Well, I'm all for that. I think it's one of the most valuable resources that we have, and certainly a tribute to the wisdom of the American system to preserve these national parks, and we work on that all the time. Well, there's some interesting things happening. Why don't you give us an idea of some of the activities happening around the nation in our national parks?
This year's National Park Week is April 18th to the 24th, and this year's theme is National Parks, America's Gift to the World. And we have various events going on throughout the country. For example, in Ohio, at the Cuyahoga Valley National Park, there's a run and a walk and a cleanup event on April 23rd. In Texas at Chamizal National Memorial, there's a walk and a kite flying contest on April 23rd. And at Rock Creek Parkway here in Washington, D.C., there's an Earth Day event and a hike on April 24th.
Do you have a favorite that you think is kind of interesting?
I think the one in Ohio at Cuyahoga Valley National Park. It sounds like a neat event.
That's a great park. It really is a very diverse park, which actually is very new to the National Park System. It follows the Cuyahoga River and has the railroad and a series of restored buildings and historical buildings and lots going on there. That's
they have a big education center, so there's definitely a lot of education activities going on as well.
Now, if people wish to find out more about what's happening, what's the best way for them to do so?
They can access the National Park Week website, which is located at www.nps.gov/NPWEEK, National Park Week.
Now, another aspect of the National Park Week is the March for Parks. People have an opportunity to do what?
March for Parks is an event that any national, local, or state park can hold, an event either to celebrate their park or do a fundraising event. In past years, people have done trail repairs. They've done raised money to do, like, bilingual guides for the parks or park cleanups. And it can be held anywhere, anytime during National Park Week or sometimes anytime in the springtime. It's a great event. A lot of schools and community members come together to celebrate their parks.
Now, is that also included on the National Park Week
webpage? Yes, there's a March for Parks page right off the National Park Week website.
Why don't you give us that website again?
Sure. It's www.nps.gov/NPWEEK.
I hope we have millions and millions of people out in our national parks this upcoming week to help celebrate the wonder of our national park system. Shannon Stone, thank you so much for adding your voice to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
Sound like fun? Well, I'm just about to tell you how you can add some real excitement, explore your interests, and surround yourself in some of the world's most spectacular natural wonders. You, yes, you, can become a volunteer in our national parks. We took an excursion out to Washington, D.C. to learn more.
Next week is National Park Week, and it's a great time to really think about our national parks and all of the extraordinary wonders that are available. There's lots of ways to enjoy parks. So certainly you can do day use. You can actually work in parks. You can also do extended backcountry treks and camp and everything else. But there's another way to enjoy our national parks that a lot of people are aware of, and that is to volunteer. And there's quite an active program to encourage people to volunteer in parks, and we're talking with Joy Peachman, who is the director of the National Parks Volunteer Program. Joy, welcome to the Wildside News.
Yes, hi, thank you.
What kind of opportunities might people think about when they think about volunteering in the National Park Service?
There are numerous opportunities, as varied as the national parks are themselves, and there's many things that people can do. They can give tours, they can clean trails, they can scan photographs into image archives, they can do all kinds of things, beach patrol, bike patrol, horse patrol. So there's many different things that are available.
If people, let's say, were interested in volunteering in a park in their own region, which they might be able to do throughout the year, what would be a good way for them to find out what's available?
The best way to find out which parks are in one's area is to go to nps.gov. and to visit the various park sites that are on the website.
It is kind of interesting. When you go there, you can literally choose a park and see what volunteer opportunities are available. In some cases, they say to just contact a park. And, of course, you can find out that information then by going to that park, and there's phone numbers and email information available. In some cases, they actually list things that people can be doing, the types of volunteers that they'll be looking for.
Go to www.nps.gov. and you click on Parks and Recreation, that will take you to the park profile pages. So you can view the parks by alphabetical listing, you can view them by geographic search. Once someone finds a park in their area, then, as you said, they can click on the volunteer link, which will list specific volunteer opportunities for that particular site. They can also go to www.volunteer.gov/gov. And that will provide a listing of all volunteer opportunities, not only with the National Park Service, but also with the other land management agencies. All applications, whether you're in the National Park Service web pages looking through the opportunities listed there, or you're in volunteer.gov, all of the applications go through the same process. So they will go directly to the park in which someone might be interested in volunteering.
when a person volunteers in a park, I imagine there's lots of different styles of relationships that a person can have. For example, there may be people who can do sort of day use, I mean, those come in for a day on a regular basis, but there's also more extended versions of volunteering. Why don't you talk about some of those opportunities?
Yes, the majority of our volunteer opportunities are still more long-term. However, we are attempting at this point to create more episodic opportunities, such as, you know, one day clean up, those sorts of things, because there are a lot of people that aren't able to commit to a lot of time to volunteer but would still like to volunteer, so they could come on a Saturday when there's a large beach cleanup or something like that, or they can apply to these opportunities that are online, which are more long term. You know, we have people that come in once a week, or, you know, we have some volunteers that volunteer every day for years and years. So again, that will vary depending on the site and depending on what type of position and what type of job they will be doing.
Now, some people actually end up staying in a park as a volunteer.
Correct.
What type of an arrangement is that?
Well, some parks offer various forms of park housing, and that could be anything from, you know, a trailer pad where one, you know, may be serving as a campground host and they would be able to hook up with their RV. Some may offer a campsite. Others may have a house or an apartment of some sort. So, again, that varies. And normally the opportunities that are posted will mention whether housing is available.
Are stipends available in some cases?
No, no stipends. The volunteer program reimburses for incidental or out-of-pocket expenses. So the types of things that someone would be reimbursed for would be uniform, transportation, meals, that sort of thing. However, they may be reimbursed. It's not always guaranteed. It depends on the park, and it depends on how they reimburse. They might just be reimbursed a flat amount per day, maybe $6 a day, for example, or they may have to provide receipts for various things that would be associated with performing their duties.
Right, and that's something to clear with a park manager or whoever's coordinating that project before you go there, to just make sure you understand all the all the details.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I talked with someone over at Yosemite, and they have some people who are volunteering to do programs. That sounds exciting. Is that somewhat common?
Yes. The majority of our volunteers are in the Division of Interpretation, and I can give you a figure for FY04.
Well, I think the number that I saw was 140,000 volunteers total in
that 2000. Yes, that's the total for FY04. And interpretation, out of 5 million hours, for interpretation we had 1,976,000 hours, which comes out to 39% of the total number of hours contributed by volunteers in FY04. So interpretation still stands out as the leader in volunteer opportunities in the parks. However, all the other divisions within the National Park Service also have volunteer programs. And the two other categories with large numbers of volunteer hours that are runners-up to interpretation are maintenance, which is at 19%, and natural resource management, which is at also at 19%. So those are the three largest categories by far of any of the other categories in which volunteers contribute.
I think the most exciting parts about volunteering is that in many cases you're going to go through some professional preparation and training, because as a person who is representing the parks, you really have to reinforce all that the National Park System really offers. Talk a little bit about what types of training they may be experiencing.
Again, depending on the type of position that one may be placed in, they will receive training that will introduce them to the park itself. They will receive safety training. They may receive training in interpretation and, you know, maybe the history of the story of the site itself. But again, that's going to vary from park to park.
Now, also, the National Park Service is expanding their artist in residency program. That's very exciting. People can find out more about that by going to the website, going to the Volunteer in Parks program on the National Park Service website, and look for artists in residence. And I'm really thrilled, because at this point there must be about 20, 25 parks that offer an artist in residency program. And of course that varies, but talk about some of the opportunities there for artists.
Some of the different opportunities that we have for artists in the park include two-dimensional visual artists, photographers, sculptors, performers, writers, video and filmmakers, composers, and all different types of artisans, craft artists, many different types of projects that can be done within the national parks as far as artists are concerned. They would be in residency for a period of time, and the length of the residencies will vary depending on the park. Part of the requirement is to provide some type of program to the public with regard to the art project and, you know, interpretation.
In some cases, there are even cabins and the housing provided for an artist, or in other cases, it may be that you bring in your rig and they'll provide you a spot as well. That's really exciting stuff. Joy, I want to thank you so much for helping us understand better about the opportunities for volunteering in our national parks, and thank you for lending your voice to the Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you very much.
Always something amazing to do on good old planet Earth, or at least it is for most of us. But some of us may not be willing volunteers for what lies ahead. When we return, a journey into the future of planet Earth is told through the eyes of legendary film producer Hal Wiener. When your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
An early childhood song chants, "This way and that way and this way and that way." Where are we headed? We seem to hear those words every day in the mainstream media. But an amazing PBS series is coming to a close. It's A Journey to Planet Earth, and it concludes this week and next. Which way are we going? We find out when we return here on the Wild Side News. This week and next are the concluding programs of a wonderful series on PBS entitled Journey to Planet Earth. Today we talk with the producer of the show, Hal Wiener, about the conclusions he makes following such a comprehensive analysis of the state of our Earth.
PBS is finishing up a series this week and next week that really has provided an extraordinary overview of planet Earth. It's referred to as Journey to Planet Earth, and we're talking to Hal Wiener, who is one of the co-producers of this show. Hal, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Good to be here.
Now, you've done a whole series of amazing films. You and your wife, Marilyn, have done over 225 documentaries and some major films and have won outstanding awards at every level, including 29 Cine Golden Eagles. And what has brought you to this point of really focusing on planet Earth?
Well, we've been focusing on environmental issues now since 1992. That's when we were asked to do the opening film for the Earth Summit down in Rio.
Mm-hmm.
After we did that show, the Assistant Secretary General of the UN said, "You know what? What the world needs is a continuing series about the environment." We said, "Sure, why not?" But it took us a while to get it off the ground. But we've been doing Journey to Planet Earth since 1999. It's been an extraordinary journey.
How in the world did you decide? There were so many segments to this. Let me just review some for the listeners. River of Destiny, which really focused on rivers. The Urban Experience, Land of Plenty, Land of Want. On the Brink, which suggests the animals and species that are endangered. Seas of Grass, that deals with the grasslands, hot zones. And now we're talking about the state of the planet and future conditional, which is the culmination of this series. But how did you come up with these different categories?
A couple of reasons. We do an extraordinary amount of reading. We try to see what's available. We try to find out what people don't know but would like to learn more about in terms of the environment. We have advisors. And then we try to find out what really are the cutting-edge stories. And it's not the cutting-edge stories of today, but the cutting-edge stories of tomorrow. And we've been fortunate to really pick some stories that have legs, so to speak.
You've traveled literally all over the world to put this series together. And
about 42 countries.
40? Wow. That's extraordinary. Just generally speaking, mano a mano, human to human, after traveling that much around the world, what makes most note to you?
Well, you know, a couple of things. Generally speaking, we see great things around the world. We see cultures that are, many cultures that are thriving. We see communities that are thriving. And we see people in many parts of the world living longer and living better quality of life. But on the dark side, there are still billions of people without fresh water, billions of people suffering from health consequences because of environmental issues and problems. We see cultures that also are not thriving. We know that 90% of all the languages in the world are going to disappear. We know that cultures are disappearing, and we see globalization in a way that most people don't see, because we go to the most rural and desolate parts of the world, and we'll see a Nike swish and a swish, or we'll see cell phones, and we'll see TV, and we'll see ads for Pepsi Cola and Coca Cola, and that's an indication that this world is getting much, much smaller.
And of course, what you just talked about is part of the challenge, because everybody wants the goods, you know? And the trouble is, the real question is, have we, as Lester Brown referred, have we outgrown planet Earth?
Well, there are some people that say that we have, and certainly I don't believe that. But we're certainly in a very, very perilous state. When 1.2 billion people in China and 1 billion people in India want to live the same lifestyles, and they should, as the people in the United States, the consequences are enormous. The price of oil will skyrocket. The competition for food will become keener, and prices will go up, and therefore those without, meaning right now probably most of sub-Saharan Africa, will suffer. These are very, very serious issues. But, you know, the one of the major issues is a lot of people have made the environment into a red state, blue state situation. Last night, one of our shows, State of the Planet, aired on most PBS stations. And it's so interesting. We get lots of emails. We get lots of emails, mostly people saying that they like the show and they'd like to use it in schools, and we accommodate them. But it's interesting to see some of the hate mail. And I find that really extraordinary that people think that our position on the environment is a political issue. It's a left-wing issue. It's an anti-religious issue. And that's very disturbing.
We have to somehow just push around those and move on, because there's so many people doing great things on the planet who are aware of these problems and are working aggressively to address them. Let's talk about what the state of the planet is then, Hal.
Well, the state of the planet right now is in a very precarious situation. The big issues over the next 10 to 20 years will be water, food, and climate change. There's no question about that. Our climate is changing. There's going to be sea level rise. The amount of sea level rise, we do not know. The amount of climate change, we do not know, though we know there will be change. And in some parts of the world, it will be devastating. We do know that right now, 1 billion people go to sleep without the proper nourishment. 2 people do not have access to fresh water, clean water. These are harsh realities. And we also know that the government and industry is very slow to act on these problems. Unfortunately, when we elect people to office, we elect them for 6 years, 4 years, 2 years. And environmental problems are they last longer than that. And unfortunately, we need our public servants to think about what's going to happen 10, 20, 30 years from now. And I think those are big issues.
What would you recommend in terms of trying to help people understand? Well, you're doing that. Your series certainly has done that. I won't even ask that question. You're doing everything you possibly can in a very brilliant and forceful way to make people aware of this. You also, by the way, this particular segment, The State of the Planet, is airing this week, and the next week, which starts on the 18th, is Future Conditional.
Right.
Talk about that.
Well, Future Conditional is an interesting show. We highlight, there are three or four stories that we highlight. Number one, we do about 10 minutes in the Arctic, and what's interesting about the Arctic, which is the most pristine place in the world, there's really no cars up there, there's no industry up there, but it's also one of the most toxic places in the world. The chemicals that are released into the atmosphere in the lower latitudes make their way up into the Arctic. They get into the food chain. They get into the sea mammals and into the fish, and then the people up there who depend upon them for sustenance eat these animals, and it turns out that Inuit women's breast milk is 23% more toxic than those living in lower latitudes. It's a serious problem. So we do that story, and then we do a story about probably the most serious environmental catastrophe that's ever taken place, and that's the RLC. The RLC is shrinking, as we know, but as it shrinks, it releases toxic dust storms for a variety of reasons, and the people living around the RLC in Uzbekistan have some of the highest rates of tuberculosis, birth defects, kidney cancer, just a whole slew of, and poverty. But what we do then is connected to the Salton Sea, which is just outside of Palm Springs in California. And the same issue and the same problem is happening just outside of Palm Springs. And they're letting the Salton Sea dry up, which is a toxic dump for agricultural chemicals. And you're going to have toxic dust storms sweeping across Palm Springs. And nobody wants to step up to the plate because it's very expensive to solve these problems. And the reason why the Salton Sea is drying up is that the farmers there have sold approximately 10% of their water to the city of San Diego. There are huge water problems in California.
Extraordinary challenges ahead. You have actually, this is sort of like watching The Apprentice and knowing the answer. You know what the answers are. You've actually formulated these into your films. What sort of visions do you have for how we are going to deal with this, how we best deal with it, and what the future may look like for planet Earth?
Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, a more enlightened public makes for more enlightened voters. It makes for people that get involved in community activities. Small steps will solve big problems. So if we can get people to take get involved in local initiatives, one of the things we suggest is to go to our website, pbs.org, Journey to Planet Earth, and there are a lot of ways to get involved in local initiatives, and these are local educational initiatives. There is also a website called TriScience, TriScience.org, and there are wonderful environmental activities for families that get them out into their communities, and they can monitor air pollution, and they'll be able to ultimately monitor water pollution and a variety of other issues. As for the future of planet Earth, I'm very optimistic. I don't think there's a choice. I think we have to be optimistic, but with that becomes we need a sense of realism, and we have to understand that we cannot stop thinking and caring and doing something about the environment.
So the question becomes partly, how do we depoliticize this? How do we reconnect people and their environment in a way that leads to health and sustainability?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't know what the answer is. And this is not a Republican-Democrat issue. Under the last several administrations, we have not heard a major call for conservation. 40% of the oil used in the United States goes into use of automobiles. And by simply improving gas efficiency in our automobiles, we can be well on the way of trying to cope with our dependence on foreign oil. You know, so you know, what is the future? It's very hard to say, but we certainly have to let our congressmen, I think, know that we care about things. I don't believe in screaming and shouting. I just believe in letting people know and letting our congressmen, our senators, our local officials know that we really want to do something and we care about the environment. It's as simple as that.
Well, you know, the environment actually, it turned into the environmental movement, but it started out as a conservation movement, which was really not political. It was about the earth and about our forests and lands and things, and unfortunately it became politicized. We definitely, for America's sake and for the sake of the planet here, need to kind of leave the politics behind, because it is not about, as you say, it is not at all about politics. It's really about a better world, and this is something that we want and we need. You're doing so many wonderful things to do this. I certainly take my hat off to you. Now, of course, Matt Damon, the wonderful actor, is very much involved in this. How do you find his passion for the earth expressed?
Well, you know, Matt is very serious about environmental issues, number one. Number two, he's a very good spokesperson because he's Harvard-educated and passionate about doing something about the earth. The other thing is, of course, he's a very good writer. You know, he's an Academy Award-winning screenwriter. So that when we work with Matt, it's not merely saying to him, please read the script and go on camera and say nice things. He's part of the entire collaboration. And I think he speaks well to young people. And this is really his main reason why he's involved in this initiative, is to get young people interested in environmental issues. And if you can get the next generation to really be enlightened and educated about the environment, I think then we will depoliticize the environmental issues at hand.
As you've heard him talk about this, do you feel that he is seeing that sort of a change in his generation and kids coming up?
It's too early to tell whether there's change or not. Unfortunately, young people don't vote. When I mean young people, I mean people that are old enough to vote, they're still not voting. And I think a lot has to be done. But, you know, we all do what we can. And certainly Matt Damon is out there really trying to lead the way.
Well, so are you, Hal. I've been talking with Hal Wiener, and also your collaborator is your wife, Marilyn.
Absolutely.
And tell what is her role in this? So just so I want to represent this fairly.
Number one, Marilyn conceived the idea for the series.
There you go.
And number two, she's the producer of the show, so I work for her.
Perfect. Well, listen, Hal, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. You're doing extraordinary work. Keep that up, and I certainly appreciate having your voice on the Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Check your local listings for the Journey to Planet Earth series airing this week and next on PBS. When we return, we head on over to one of America's premier national parks, Yosemite, as our celebration of National Park Week ramps up here on Your Voice of the Earth. The Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
At times like this, when taxes dominate our time, it's worth the effort to think about where all that money goes. Now, I'm not going to get into that debate. But I will tell you that one of the best uses of our tax money is for the ongoing management of our national park system. Next week is National Park Week, and to see your tax dollars at work, we preview the dedication of the Yosemite Falls Redevelopment Project. It's well worth a visit next week, or this summer, as the Wild Side News keeps you moving forward into a better world. The week of April 18th through the 24th is National Park Week. So now it's time to head on out to America's premier wonder, Yosemite National Park, which is getting ready to unveil the Lower Falls Redevelopment Project. So let's see what's up.
Next week is National Park Week. And there's a series of events happening around the country to celebrate National Park Week. None perhaps more spectacular in some ways than what is happening at one of our premier national parks, Yosemite National Park. And to help us understand what's going on is Adrian Freeman, who is a park ranger, has been with the park for actually a relatively short period of time. But Adrian, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Monday, April 18th, is a very special day. Why don't you help us understand what's going on at Yosemite that makes that such a special moment?
It is the dedication of the brand new Lower Yosemite Falls Trail. And the Lower Yosemite Falls Trail is a project that was originally launched in 1997. The Lower Yosemite Falls area gets between 1 million and 1.5 million visitors every year, and it needed some restoration. The official dedication will happen on April 18th.
And what sort of plan for that day?
Oh, gosh, it's going to be a big shindig. We're having speeches by Fran Minella, who is the director of the National Park Service, along with speakers from the Yosemite Fund, who in a large way contributed monetarily to this project. We'll hopefully hear from Larry Halperin, who was the landscape architect in charge of the design, as well as Mike Collison, the superintendent here at Yosemite, and several other dignitaries.
Now, in April, what kind of weather are you expecting? Is it going to be kind of outdoors or kind of a combination of both?
It is outdoors. And today it's about 65 in Yosemite Valley, but on Friday it snowed. So it really could go anyway. We don't know.
That's the high country.
We've got Gore-Tex.
There you go. Well, tell us about what actually has happened in terms of this Yosemite Falls redevelopment. I have no idea how many millions of people have visited the falls throughout the years. This goes back a very long time, as a matter of fact. Give us a short, brief history of Yosemite, and then we'll talk about what the plan is.
You know, it obviously has traditional values. There were several Native American villages in the area, the last one dating to about 5,000 years ago. There was a tourist camp, the Lost Arrow Camp, which holds a dear place in many people's hearts. And James Hutchings, who was one of the earliest European-American settlers in Yosemite Valley, came here first in about 1855. He actually built a hotel on the opposite side of the valley and then cleared a viewway through to Yosemite Falls. Now, Yosemite Falls falls in three cascades. It's the tallest waterfall in North America. We believe it's now the sixth tallest in the world, although they keep finding remote falls in places like inland Africa, so we keep getting bumped down a little bit. But it's spectacular. It's an amazing fall. And as I said, it gets, you know, about 1.5 million visitors a year. And the area was really starting to show it. It had lots of visitor use trails, trails that were not official but which wound their way through the woods, which people would follow. It had inadequate bathroom facilities. And it used to be a parking lot. It used to be where we parked the buses. So in essence, you would go to see the tallest waterfall in North America and come out to a place where, you know, sometimes 40 buses and cars were parked. And we've given it sort of back its space as the tallest waterfall in North America and restored it to its natural beauty so that people, when they come there, aren't affected as much by technology but more by nature.
So why don't you talk about what now people will be able to experience?
People have a picnic area. They won't be greeted. There used to be a bathroom that was just not adequate for the number of visitors that were coming to visit the falls. And so you'd be greeted by the sight of, you know, several dozen people in line for these restroom facilities. And now there's a restroom facility that's in scale with the falls and with the need. you have signs that give people a good interpretation of the area, both its cultural values and its natural values. One of the biggest improvements to this area is that the Eastern Trail does meet federal standards for the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Now, I also understand that the architect for this came up with some rather unique ways to even implement the trail itself using materials that typically haven't been used in the past.
We did use a number of recycled materials. So we used, you know, the trees that were removed were then used for fencing. Asphalt was removed from different places and reused in the trails. So there is an aspect of recycling within the park. I know they did attempt to use a non-petroleum-based material in order to make that trail so be less impactful to the creek itself.
And so in terms of the experience itself, is there a greater visual opportunity there?
There is, because it's not blocked by buses. It also is designed to accommodate the number of people that want to visit it. And so while you have the same, probably the same number of people visiting, you have more of a sense of the natural elements. It's because it's simply designed to accommodate that number of people.
That's been a long time in development. Now, of course, this follows on the flood that really affected Yosemite in such a tremendous way. Give us an update on what has happened since the flood.
The flood, of course, did manage to change a lot of the way we thought about building in the park, and it did help us launch the Yosemite Valley Plan. And it's important to note that Yosemite Falls restoration is part of the Yosemite Valley Plan. It is a plan to restore and restructure resources to fit the changing needs of visitors. Other projects that are going along with that in the Yosemite Valley Plan include improvements on our infrastructure. So we're doing massive reconstruction on sewers right now, which were damaged during the flood and before. We're rerouting a sewer route from Curry Village. We're integrating utilities. There was at one point that the sewer line crossed the river 15 times, and it now will cross twice. So major changes in infrastructure are happening, major improvements.
Well, I wish I could say that I have been to Yosemite recently. I need to visit again.
You do.
And here's the reason. I'm a landscape painter. One of the things I do is I love to paint the earth. I don't believe there's any more spectacular landscape in America than in Yosemite. It is a palette of wonder. There's extraordinary features. Why don't you give an overview of some of the things that people who may not have ever been to Yosemite can experience in Yosemite Park.
It's awe-inspiring. It just is. There is nothing like the light in Yosemite Valley. It's 3,000-foot walls in some places. This flat valley floor with these meadows that at the moment are green and just incredibly full of wildflowers. Yosemite Falls is not the only impressive waterfall by any means. Some of them we don't even name because they're just running off the rock with the snow melt at this point. We have icons like El Capitan, which is famous among human, besides with human uses, it's also famous because it's one of the largest unjointed pieces of granite in the world, which means it's just a massive rock. It rises over 3,000 feet above the valley floor, and it rises almost completely vertically. So it's just incredible. And
yeah.
Half Dome is iconic in so many ways to so many people. Outside the valley is just as impressive. In Yosemite, the giant sequoias, we have three groves here, and they're unbelievable until you see them, how big they really are. You think, a big tree. But you come there, and you're just struck. And I work every day in Yosemite Valley, and I drive in every day through 140, and there's not a day in the world that I don't look and see some amazing thing that struck me before. Maybe it's the light hitting one of the waterfalls in a certain way and producing a rainbow, or a herd of deer meandering across the road. It's an incredible, incredible place, and it's very spiritual for many, many people.
Talk also about the opportunities for people to family camp or individual camp, getting into the backcountry, and then also day use.
It's an interesting, we've had an interesting change, and this is fairly consistent with other major national parks, where we're getting more day users. People used to come to national parks and stay for a week. The bad news is most families can't travel that way anymore. So Yosemite is in the process of designing a place that's more user-friendly for day users. We have a number of picnic areas. where you can come and stay. We have a day-use parking lot. You can come, park your car, leave it there. Hop on a free shuttle bus. It'll take you about an hour to get all the way around the valley, and you can look up and not drive at the same time, which is great for everyone else on the road, but it's great for you, too. You can get on and off as many times as you want. That's a great way to experience the valley. There are campgrounds in Yosemite Valley. They do tend to fill quickly, although Camp 4 is a walk-in campground, and it takes, 5 minutes to walk in. It often has space, and it is first come, first serve. That's a great way to camp. Once our higher elevation campgrounds are open, especially for tent campers, except with the exception of the busiest days in the summer, there is usually a place to stay at Tamarack or at Yosemite Creek Campground up off the Tioga Road. So there are other opportunities. Backcountry camping, of course, is something very popular to do here in Yosemite. You do need to get a wilderness permit. We enforce a quota system on the trailheads for the protection of the resource, but also for the enjoyment of the people that are out there to make sure that they have a valuable wilderness experience. But very popular places include Little Yosemite Valley, which is halfway sort of up to Half Dome, up the 17-mile Half Dome Trail. So a lot of people like to backcountry camp from there.
Well, it is one of the most spectacular experiences that in the world, Yosemite, in every sense of the word. Now, getting back to this particular upcoming week of events, you also have some interesting things happening. For example, on Friday, which would actually be Earth Day, you're having a Dr. Seuss The Lorax concert and dramatization. What is that about?
It's a riot, actually. We get our National Park Service interpreters reenact The Lorax, and it usually involves some pretty good antics, like forgetting of the lines and botched special effects, but it's pretty neat nonetheless. And if you haven't heard it for a while, it's good to hear it every year.
Where do people see that?
It is at 8 o'clock on Friday, and it is April 22nd, obviously Earth Day itself, and it will be at the Yosemite Lodge.
Now, is that bundled into your day use fee?
Oh, you bet. You come into the park, you pay $20 per car, and that's actually good for 7 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an extraordinary bargain. And then also on Saturday, you have the spirit of John Muir, one of the legendary founders of Yosemite Valley. What's that about?
The legend of John Muir will be Lee Stetson. He is an actor who portrays John Muir in the theater performances throughout the summer. He's done it for a long time, very talented guy. So the spirit of John Muir would be a great place to get an introduction to maybe the pioneering spirit that brought John Muir here to Yosemite Valley and kept him here.
Any special events happening this summer that you want to share? We have about a minute left.
Oh, my goodness. Where do you start? We have a brand-new visitor center. We have an incredible snowpack in the higher elevations. Last I checked, it was at about 166% in some places.
Wow.
So that means our falls are going to be just epic, our waterfalls with the snow melt. We have a fleet of hybrid electric diesel buses being introduced to replace our old Gillig diesel buses. These were manufactured by General Motors, and they cut down on some emissions by up to 90%, and also have a better fuel economy of about 60% over straight diesel buses. So we are really proud and really excited to be pioneering that effort in the national park.
That has been a problem in the past.
Air quality is always an issue. 7 miles long, 2 miles wide, almost 4 million visitors a year. We do have an air quality concerns at times.
Well, into the future here, that's going to be taken care of as more and more people transfer over to hybrids and hydrogen and things of that nature. It's something to really, that's really, talk about an incentive. Won't it be great when that actually has taken place and Yosemite Valley is cleared of the air problems?
There have been lots of mitigating efforts that have started. One thing has been limiting campfire hours, cooperation with the state boards on air quality, hiring a natural resource person who is simply responsible for air quality management here in the park. The buses will help. The more we can encourage people to take them and leave their cars in the parking lot, the better it will be. But there have been lots of mitigating effects put into action.
We're getting better at this all the time.
I think so. Proud to be part of it.
Yeah. Well, Adrian Freeman, Park Ranger, Yosemite National Park, one of the premier, most amazing places on the planet. I want to thank you for lending your voice to the voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
You're very welcome.
So there's plenty of great opportunity for you to enjoy this planet Earth. We have a lot to be thankful for. We are very blessed, in particular because America has, as part of its permanent legacy, our national park system. So when you hear about plans to violate that sacred trust on our lands with gas and oil exploration and more, speak up, because we must be sure that for all time, these sacred places remain safe. Stand up for the wonder. Now go on out and have a great adventure. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet next time, or any time in the archives, on your Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News.